Heavy Networking by the Packet Pushers is sponsored today by IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/packet to save an additional 25% off your membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just be sure to use the code PACKET25 at checkout. That's PACKET25. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. Today's episode is brought to you in part by ExtraHop. Think analytics, folks. ExtraHop is the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. More on ExtraHop later in the show, but if you just can't wait, visit extrahop.com/packetpushers to find out more.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the greatest data networking podcast that's happened on the podcasting scene, perhaps, maybe. Today I'm talking with Sal Rananizzi. Now, Sal is a network architect at a very large company, and I'll let him introduce himself in a second. The unique thing about Sal is I recently met him during an event. We had a live event in New York, which was hosted by Glueware, and Sal was one of their guests. And we started to have a chat. He was talking to me about his journey to SDN. And what I wanted to do was to recap that journey just between me and him in a backwards and forwards about how over the last, 5 years or 8 years of looking at SDN, the journey that they've been through as a very large organization and the life cycle of that approach, in the hope that you in the audience can learn something about that process and listen to the discussion, and maybe that'll help to inform your SDN journey for whatever definition of software-defined networking it might be. So, Sal, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for joining us. Tell people a little bit about yourself, perhaps, just to kick this off.
Oh, hey, Greg. Thank you so much for having this discussion again. It's my third time with you guys. It's been quite an interesting journey. Yeah. So, yeah, I work for a very large pharma company here in New Jersey, Merck, which there's a lot of large pharma here. And it's been quite a long road to get to where we've gone today. And it certainly has not been a primrose path by any stretch of the imagination. It's been quite challenging to get where we are today. So looking forward to getting into this with you.
So you're sort of in charge, or you're part of a team, but you're at the top of the hierarchy. So it's to some extent, it's your decision, or you're a big part of the decision that influences the networking at Merck.
Yeah, that's a interesting question. I'm trying to take a step higher view, as I'm getting on in age and try to get out of the weeds, which is not always easy to do, and try to really focus more on like strategy and where we're going to be, like not today, tomorrow, next month, but the long term view. But it's a very, very large organization, and it's not always the easiest thing to do to get everybody on the same page, to say the least. And I'm sure you can relate to that.
Well, it's this idea. I imagine that the organization as big as Merck is many different business units, and each one would have IT functions devolved to them. They maybe have local responsibility in some cases. In some cases, they're closely aligned with global strategy. In some cases, they just don't ignore you and go off and do their own thing. It's not like a big company is always just one thing.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as things have ebbed and slowed now, so we really have three IT hubs, Singapore, Prague, and the US. And the engineering team is spread across those regions. And we create the standards for LAN, WAN, data center architecture. And we go through a very rigorous process to get these published and signed off and published to document them, all this type of stuff. And of course, there's always snowflakes, right? And I talk about this a lot. So I can show you like any engineering document that we have. If you had a console cable and an IP address, you should be able to follow this document to a T and configure any device on our network. Now, I talked about this before too, like paper standards are a problem, right? Yeah. Because you publish these standards and somebody, again, third parties are doing our implementations. Right. And that guy has the last site that he did, whether right or wrong, he has a file that he just uses to copy and paste in. So it's challenging, to say the least, because once you go down a bad road, it's very hard to get off it and get on the right path.
Yeah. I guess the other part about paper standards that I've worked in big companies where I've written those standards documents, and then you go out to the field and say, to check up or to follow up, and you say, when you read this, what did you see? And it's like a classic case of Chinese whispers. You get there and this guy's going, you wrote down this model of this router with this iOS using this configuration. He says, oh no, I went and bought this brand because we couldn't find that one in this country, so we just bought whatever we liked. Or he'd had some configuration in there and he said, well, I just made it that way because that's what I understand. The whole interpretation of paper standards is just so diverse over time, I think.
Right. Or you get someone says, it says enter password here, and they actually put an enter password here, as the password.
Do I need to put a full stop at the end of that, or can I leave this one? Yeah.
Exactly. But again, another big issue is mergers, right? It's a constant ebb and flow of us buying companies and selling companies and doing all this type of stuff. And that's what makes it hard. So that's really kind of like the next thing I'm trying to think about, how we can bring these companies on board much quicker. But you're absolutely right. And then, you know, so Merck was, you know, we bought Sharing Plow, mm-hmm. bought a company called Organon. And there's still a lot of legacy stuff out there that is doesn't meet the new standards. And the problem is, like, how can you go fix that stuff? Right, very hard to retrofit a legacy thing, and even if I made a change to a paper standard now, it's hard to fix that.
Yeah, no, I mean it is hard to fix it, but also a lot of that stuff in those big companies. I'm imagining that your drug manufacturing, so you've got factories out there that run 365 days, 24/7. They don't stop just because your networking asset needs an upgrade.
Yeah, that's a great point. We really have no formal change window. I mean, when I worked in finance in Jersey City at a large bank, everybody knew the third Saturday of the month, the whole data center was down, right? Mm-hmm. And you couldn't even go in the data center during business hours. Mm-hmm. You just couldn't even go in there, right? But as things have ebbed and flowed and we have a huge SAP implementation, we don't have any maintenance windows. And you're absolutely right. On one of these plant sites, there might be, you know, $30-$50 million worth of product out there on the shop floor,
yeah.
right? And all different facets, and there's just no way. You might have one maintenance window on, you know, every 5 years or something like that. So that has been a challenge, you know? Yeah. It's like, well, we got to do a code promotion because your code has bugs, but they, you know, again, they can't stop, you know what I mean? And it's a challenge. You're absolutely right.
I wonder if this is true for you, but I found a lot of those factories had a single switch. There was no concept of having a redundant one or any redundancy. It's just like cross fingers. It's not.
Well, there are certainly some legacy sites that had some, shall we call it, interesting architectures with the switches in literally in a big loop and that kind of thing. Mm. But we have a bunch of smart guys now working on a shop floor standard, and it's very prescriptive. We have a firewall. Everything's behind the firewall, and it's very interesting. There's a Purdue model and all this other type of stuff. So. And again, it took something like the cyber incident that happened to us to really, you know, focus on it. So there always was a shop floor firewall, but it was never really locked down because nobody really can say exactly like what protocols, what ports you're using. So you put it in monitor mode and then you take a look at it and say, oh, well, we know this is happening. And then, okay, we're going to lock it down. And all of a sudden, end of year comes or something like that. And there's one port that's open and then you broke something and root cause analysis, problem incident report. And it's not a good situation, you know, but that's
reality.
That's,
I mean, that's
so now it's redundant.
But the thing is, reality, exactly. That's the network. That's the network that everybody has. We talk about, like a lot of the times on packet pushes, we talk about new stuff and shiny stuff. And I guess this leads me into the SDN thing. One of the things that I've noticed in the SDN market is that a lot of the SDN products are quite prescriptive about what you can have in your network. So if you look at SDN solutions from Cisco, they force you to use certain newer models of switches. And, you know, if you look at, say, Apstra, they want you to use certain devices in the ECMP cluster in the networking. And if you're on Big Switch, they've got their operating system. And that's how they get a certain amount of control. For some companies, there's also a marketing aspect. You know, it's much more good business for them, not for customers, of course, but for them to sell you a new range of hardware, right? Force out the old stuff and replace it. That's good money for the vendor. But the reality is, I think that real SDN, or where we see a lot of people doing automation, is saying, this is what I've got. I need to make this go. The gap there for you, you've got all of this that you can't change. And out there, you've got a bunch of vendors trying to sell you SDN solutions that say, throw out all your old stuff and we'll replace it with new stuff. And you're going, but I can't. The gap between replacement is too high.
Oh, that's a great point, Greg. I mean, we have 25,000 network devices. Right. And until 2003, Merck was a Nortel shop. Right. It wasn't until 2003 that there was a bake-off and Nortel actually lost. And I'm not, too proud to say we still have quite a few Nortel devices that have been out there for quite some time now. But you're
actually,
right.
To be fair, like, with Nortel, you know, those devices would run year in, year out.
They have been for decades, literally.
You've probably got BayRS routers out there that still run as good as they did in 2000.
Yeah, none of those, but some layer two things currently are sticking around. But you're right. And once you buy into that ecosystem, it's very hard. And that's kind of the promise of like NFV now, which a lot of people are talking about. Is it a reality now? But that's the whole point, right? You put some magic pizza box out there and you can, and then you're not married to one router or one SD-WAN solution. However, trying to get that happen, that's a whole nother discussion. But but you're right. Like once you're in this ecosystem, it's kind of hard to get out and you have all this legacy stuff. And it's going to take us years. I mean, it's like a never-ending treadmill, right? By the time you replace one platform, the next platform is end of support and end of life, and it just never ends, right?
Right. So when you started looking at SDN, I imagine you started looking at it from the point of view, because you've got it, you're Cisco partnered at this point of time, and the early days of SDN, you would have started looking at the first generation of Cisco SD-WAN solutions. I'd be very confident in saying I bet the sales reps were doorstepping you on day one about the first generation of SDN.
Yeah, it all started with this one PK thing, which was supposed to be. So in 2013, we took out 6509s in the data center and we put in 7Ks. And this one PK thing was supposed to be the be all end all. And then after that, it was kind of like a dynamic fabric architecture as we moved into fabric path and some overlay stuff. And then it was a data center network manager and then APIC EM and then CPO, and then it was a whole plethora of things. And then I had very little success with any of them. We spent a lot of money. I thought data center network manager was kind of interesting. And then as the code matured, there were some APIs and that kind of thing, but we still could never really gain any real traction. And then, of course, the Ansible thing happened, and we started taking a peek at that as well. Right.
So that journey through all of those, I guess you're in a situation where you could pilot all of those, or did you actually deploy them in certain sites to try them out?
No, that's a great. So that's something that we're very lucky to have here, and the management has been very supportive. Where I'm at in New Jersey, we have a very extensive lab, and everything we have in production, we really require to test in the lab and go through all these processes and procedures, IML and all this other type of stuff to put in production. So clearly, it was in the lab. Matter of fact, now I have a real site sitting in Iraq in my lab that's on MPLS, and it's a real site. Hmm. And if you really want to feel how painful it is to work at a remote site, you can plug into there and see what it's like to work on a 1 meg link, you know? But yeah, if you really want to feel the pain, what end users feel. And that's what we do. To test everything, because you don't want to be the guy, like I always say, no RGEs, resume generating events.
Yeah.
So you got to make sure that you.
So none of these first generation SDN solutions even made it out of the proof of concept or the testing labs.
Yeah. So we would usually do in the lab. We would do it, and then we'd pick a site.
Yeah.
To do a small site, and you know, there's some. We have 360 sites. There's some small sites. We would test some things on a small site or in a data center. And I have two pairs of 7Ks here. I can really emulate quite a few things. No, they never really because you know, like you get so far, and then you really can't cross that bridge to coalesce it into a cohesive strategy that we're going to do this, this, and this. And it was very difficult. It was very difficult to get out.
It sounds to me like though you weren't also looking at the versions of SDN solutions. So you're not looking at the data center SDN so much. Like you haven't looked at SDI, Cisco's ACI, or Juniper's Contrail, or the other data center orchestrators. Is there a reason for that? Is that because the data center is just too hard, or you know?
Oh, no. We certainly have. And I remember distinctly having a meeting with Arista very early on in 2013, where we were looking at the Nexus or Arista. And Arista had like three people in their knock or something like that, right? Yeah. And I thought it was kind of interesting, but it was a bridge too far for us at that time, right? So we put in 7Ks.
Yeah.
And then we built a new data center. We moved a data center from one of our old campuses to a new campus here in New Jersey. And we bolted on an ACI kit on there, and we are there's some very bright guys working on the ACI kit now, and that's been going very slowly, but now we put our instance of SAP on ACI, and they're doing some very interesting things. They hung some firewalls off of there, and they're taking traffic and boomeranging in and out of the firewalls. And matter of fact, there's big workshops this week how they're segmenting the data center on with it. And it's quite interesting that for the longest time, the server guys will go, Sal, I built a pod of ESX clusters over here. I have a pod of clusters over here. Then the app team would populate it. And they couldn't move workloads, so that was kind of perfect for, you know, for Trill or Fabric Path, and it worked very well. And now they're like, no, we don't want it wide open. We want it like in pockets so you can control it, right? It's just like MPLS on the WAN, right? We want any to any, anything. Oh, no, no, now we really don't want any to any because we want to apply security policy to where we want, right?
We've gotten the message about microsegmentation, and that's what we want, right?
That's exactly where we're going. And of course, you know, that little not Petra thing has really kind of fueled that happened to us.
So Merck as a brand, you had a problem where some sort of worm got inside the boundary and caused a lot of problems. So I often talk about executives need to see IT as a profit center because we can improve productivity. But you're saying it's more of a partnership. So I guess that's an image. Instead of you just being a cost center and trying to screw you to do the most with the least, they're much more saying, how can you help us make profits, but at the same time looking to manage costs? So it's more of a balance.
Yeah, and there's a lot of very interesting, there's a lot of really bright people in our organization right now, and they're doing a lot of interesting things. Some of the guys in research and high-performance computing are doing just amazing things. But the problem is that we really need to kind of get ahead of help me help you, right? Yeah. By the time something's find me, it's like, oh, we just copied a petabyte to the cloud and performance sucks. So it's like, well, you should have told me before you're going to copy a petabyte.
Infrastructure has to be there before that can happen. That's the thing that people often forget is by the time you've discovered something, infrastructure, and if you haven't spoken to infrastructure, we can't react on to a request. We might need 3 months or 6 months to wind up to get ahead of that. You know, if you need a petabyte of data transferred, it'll take us 3 months to uprate the internet connection to do that or to provision you with a special one, you know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly true. And I think it happens quite often because you might have one team is just doing data warehousing, right, for Exadata or whatever, right? Oh, we're going to buy these five new racks. And it's like, well, where are you going to plug it in? You know, and you're like, oh, Sal, you're a jerk. You're hard to work with. It's like, I'm sorry. I always say until my switch tree I planted out back starts producing switches, you're going to have to pay some money because, you know, and that's, of course, like people don't want to hear that. So I think some of that's changing too, that, you know, and then of course the power and the fiber and the data center and all that other type of stuff. It's just like, oh, here, these five pallets of stuff just showed up at the data center. Yeah. What do we do with them? You know, so that's kind of changing a little bit too now that,
My favorite one of those stories was when somebody rocked up and said, I'd bought five very big storage units. And they said, we're just going to put them in the data center. I said, where? They said, well, we found five spaces here. I said, that's fantastic. But each one of those is overweight. If you put them there, the floor will fall through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were like two tons of rack. And, you know, I said, those things are going to need 10, you know, I think it was 14 racks in the end. They needed 14 rack spaces because the data center that they wanted to put them in was only rated for 1 ton per foot or something. I can't remember the numbers. And the look on their faces was treasure. It was absolutely priceless when they thought, oh, we're just, I love those stories.
I know, that's a great example. Yeah, I know, it's very true. And like even the optics and everything, people just don't think about that.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course.
So let's get back to the path to SDN story. So you'd been working, you know, through the Cisco, the DFA era, the DCNM, all that stuff, which is all the Cisco enterprise, as opposed to, it was meant to be sort of a campusy more solution, I thought, than really a data center. ACI was always going to be the data center. And DCNM, even though it was called the Data Center Network Managers, always felt to me to be more, didn't have the sort of focus that ACI did. It runs on Tomcat. It's all Java code, which is part of the reason that DCNM never quite came together, I think.
Well, you're right, but we had a large, we have a lot of these 7Ks. Yeah. Right. And knock on wood, they're running very well. Right. It's a very prescriptive, set of VDCs we put on there, and they're working very well. And there seemed to be really no way to do any automation with those. Now, I mean, there was some APIs that were open and some scripts that I put on there that you could download, whatever. And that's what I was really kind of looking at, like looking backwards, because ACI, like, you know, we're not going to lay waste to all these, you know, it's a 5K, 7K, 2K design, very kind of standard stuff, like circa 2011, 2012, somewhere around there. And it works very well. It's very solid as the code is matured. But that was really the focus, like to deal with what we had. And then anything new. So even now, transitioning over to ACI or something, it's very challenging, right? Yeah. Because then now we're like kind of building stuff, right? And then getting them, you know, to work together.
You can't just go and
replace.
You can't take these out and replace them anytime in the next 5 to 10 years. The reality is they're there.
Yeah, no, they still have some life left on them. But I think as new things come along now, we're really taking a look at it. And like, we're not going to keep propagating this problem. Like, and where do you stop, right? So we did OTV between data centers, and it worked very, very well. But we had, you know, 8 OTV VDCs. And if you talk about the HSRP filtering, it always broke something. And then we're talking to the guy who wrote OTV, right? Francisco, right? And he's like, no, this is a bridge too far. And so as a result, we couldn't have automatic gateway failover or HSRP prioritization between data centers because it was just too complicated, right? And now even today with it on, I mean, the MAC address table is just all over the place, right? But the whole point was to get rid of this old stuff, move it off the old, 1520s or whatever, and then move it into the new part. But even that's been challenging. So now working on some ACI multi-site, which is kind of interesting with the newer stuff that, you know, it will automatically know, it'll check the route to the routing table and solve some of the boomeranging problem, right? Because that was always a problem. You're going to boomerang traffic. F5, GTM, we solved some of those problems. Some applications are doing very well with GTM.
Yeah.
But again, it's... you know, people don't really understand it. So I'm trying to, you know, lead people down the primrose path because that's working very well. We just expanded it to all 5 of our global data centers now.
Yeah. You're not there with ACI multi-site yet, but you're looking down that path. You're starting to do testing and evaluation.
They are testing it. One of my colleagues, several of my colleagues are, we're definitely going down that road, and we're going to put some more ACI in our other data centers as well right
cool.
now. Right.
So when it came to looking at your campus networks, because we obviously met talking about Glueware, and you were raving to me about the success of Glueware and its ability to automate your existing estate. So sounds to me like the data center is more or less solved in terms of ACI, in terms of orchestration, but you still need to orchestrate above the ACI. But you also got all these legacy switches, and it sounds like you've been through a whole evaluation process around SDN strategies of those, and you ended up settling on Glueware. And what was that journey like?
Yeah, that's a great question. We started with really IWAN, right? And I started doing I love the NVPN. I think it's very, you know, mature technology. It runs on, you know, almost any version of Cisco code. And Glueware actually was a little footnote on this Cisco slide about IWAN, right? And so I'm like, hey, what are these guys? And I had started chatting with them. And sure enough, we went through a very long, POC with it. And we had 4 or 5 sites. And I talked about this at ONUG in, I think, maybe 2017 when I first met you in person. And, but it was very interesting in the fact that it did a lot of neat stuff under the covers. But you had no access to the nerd knobs, right? Like I said, okay, we need to do a route policy, right, to check BGP or EGP, you know, an interior gateway protocol to an exterior gateway protocol or something like that. And it was, it wasn't exposed, right? So then we had the PO in hand. We were ready to cut the PO for a bunch of licenses with Glueware and roll out DAVPN. Boom, cyber incident happened. Everything stopped. Everything stopped. Yeah. And it was like the day before. And of course, after like a year of going through this long POC process with us, the guys at Glueware were not very happy that like the day we were going to sign the PO, we couldn't even issue a PO, right? But anyway, things kind of went dark as we fought back and
the
recovery process.
Fix the problems, fix the challenges,
Right. But we do have, we had 4 or 5 sites done with Glueware at the time. And then we were going to an EBB at San Jose with Cisco. Mm-hmm. And my buddy and I drove up to Sacramento, and they're like, check out this new Glueware 3.0. And we sat in the room with everybody from the company, and they showed us this whole new thing that they've done. And what they've really done is expose the nerd knobs to us. We can now have the control over the engine that they've done. And I've called it the secret sauce before. So now you can actually understand what's going on and look at this framework of automation. And you know CLI, and you know, like, you know, the whole construct of the CLI. you can envision this and build these automation pieces that everybody can understand because everybody knows.
So when you say nerd knobs, you're talking about the nerd knobs in Glueware or the nerd knobs in the network devices?
So the nerd knobs in Glueware, which I'd be before the 3.0 version of the tool came out, you really didn't have much control over the engine. Like, so I would do a demo, right? And I would have the wrong serial number. I didn't reset everything. Like, it would take a box from scratch and throw on this huge, complicated DNVPN thing, right? Yeah. And even IP addressing and everything.
Hundreds because you and hundreds of lines of DNVPN.
Oh, yeah. I mean, IPsec, all that stuff was done, right? And even now, we're running DNVPN in production on probably 30, 40 sites. And that's all done with Glue. And even the guys from Glue said, This model of automation we have for DNVPN is like ginormous. It's huge. Yeah. It's one of the biggest ones they've ever seen, and it works great, right?
Right. So let's just drill into that for a minute, because I think if you're working in something like Ansible, which is another way to do this, you get Ansible, you write your playbooks, you work out the configs that you want. But the challenge here is that in a site of 30 or 40 sites like what you're talking about, you've probably got four or five different types of devices in the DNVPN, like model of Cisco, that model of this, and an ASA or a Firepower or an iOS router. And stitching those configs together with an Ansible playbook would be a substantial challenge, right?
Yeah, and I had the tower, Ansible tower, set up. I had it linked to to Git and all this other type of stuff, and we were doing some stuff, and Dave from Ansible was here, and we were making some headway. And the main thing I was trying to do with Ansible was we have a huge BGP routing table, as sure as enterprises like us do, and I wanted to grab like a state of the routing table before and after the change and doing kinds of things like that. You really need the playbook to make it meaningful, right? And I started to build some playbooks. But what we're doing now, the main driver for what we did and how we got funding and did this thing was because of OneDrive and Office 365 deployment, right? And Windows 10, right? So they were building out, they were putting out OneDrive links to everybody, and they were putting distribution points all over the world. And we have a very, very large cost policy. So this was the real driver that we started with Glueware, right? And I talked about this at the Intent event, right? So we were able to make changes across all 400 routers, literally with the push of a button. So as we started building these models and threads of automation, like the OneDrive guys, hey, we're putting a distribution point up in the Far East, in Singapore or whatever, and then all those users in the Far East would go to that distribution point and pull tons of data out to do the images or whatever, and we're able to, you know, at least grab all that stuff and throw it in scavenger class so it wouldn't bury the network. But this is how we really started with this whole thing, right?
So let me read that back to you and see if I can just read that. So you have this DNVPN network, which is all this legacy infrastructure, like in a modern SD-WAN appliances, which is what we talk about a lot. You've got this auto recognition. You just say, you know, Microsoft Azure or Cisco Office 365, Microsoft Office 365 or the Microsoft Mail client. You just select it, and then the SD-WAN boxes do all that for you. But you've got this legacy stuff, and you have to create a match for all of that Microsoft Office 365 traffic manually by IP address, by port numbers, by whatever tools are available in the device. And that might vary from an iOS router that's 15 years old to an ASA that's got a pretty arcane application recognition model to a modern Firepower that's got quite an advanced application inspection engine, right? So it's not... The work that's done in SD-WAN would have been highly desirable, but you're not about to go and replace everything. Just what you needed to do is make the most of this existing technology.
Exactly, and that's a great point. So if you remember the IWAN stuff, right, and you know, the DNVPN piece, very solid. There was something called performance routing, where you could do some of those types of things. We did not go down that road, but what we did, we were able to do across many, many platforms. I mean, look, we still have 3,700 routers out there, 2,800 routers, 3,800 routers, and even though the guys are like, we can't officially support these, but we were able to make changes on them, and that's really part of this whole thing, that it's completely abstracted. I mean, plethora of code iterations, right, over all the years. Yeah. And you're right, we made the best of what we could at the time by changing the cost policy across all these devices. And, you know, but that's the whole point. Once you go through the pain, and it's 95% upfront work when you build these things, and then it's just clicking a button, right? Yeah. So you're absolutely right. We built what we had to build and to get over this process, and it was very successful, by the way. But, you know.
You're still working there, so yeah, it must have been successful. No,
no RGEs yet, Greg, but give me time.
I guess the other trick here is that you might create an access list, but it's going to represent differently in an iOS as it is to an ASA, as it is to some other devices. You know, different iOS versions, different boxes. You would actually have to adapt. Let's just focus on that as a single part of the point. You would have to be adaptively selecting which part of the ACL went to certain devices. It's not just a case of one ACL just gets pushed to 400 devices. It's literally subjective according to the case.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that. So we have not done ASAs yet. Like we built a model for ASAs to completely install it. But in production, we haven't touched ASA. We did just build a kill switch for an ASA. We have TUFIN. We have a lot of things, and we have firepower. We have Panorama now. We have a lot of things. But what the business asked for was a kill switch, so you can import a context into Glue and quickly change an access list with one push of a button. But then, of course, CSM gets out of it. So that's one point, right? Yeah, we do have an ASA model, and we can do it with Glue, but there's so many other tools. But what we did was we have one standard access list for quality service, right? All the policy maps,
focused on that
and
one
that
thing
goes
first.
On everything.
Okay, right.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to pause our podcast discussion for a word from our sponsor today, IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV, they are flexible, online, technical training. Why training? Training helps you take advantage of the career paths that are available in IT, and IT has an incredibly strong career path right now. A recent MIT study shows that IT occupations have grown by nearly 20% between 2004 and 2017. That is more than 8 times the growth rate of other career paths. Earnings are growing for folks in IT as well, even though earnings are flat for college grads on the average. IT Pro TV can help you take advantage of these IT career trends with courses covering CompTIA and Cisco and EC Council, VMware, and lots more. There are over 4,000 hours of binge-worthy, on-demand training content out there for you. The hosts that are presenting the information, they're doing it in engaging, a talk show kind of a format to keep you paying attention. And they're live every day if you like live content, but then that live content goes studio to web in 24 hours so you can stream it whenever you're ready. Courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role, so you can find what you're looking for without a lot of headache. You can stream the courses, of course, live or, again, on demand via any method you're looking for. Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, their iOS or Android apps. You got all those sorts of choices. And the big idea here, make it easy to learn your stuff, then go pass your exams, earn your certs, and then land your next great job with the help of training from IT Pro TV. So how do you do it? Visit itpro.tv/packet to take advantage of their lowest prices ever. That's itpro.tv/packet. itpro.tv/packet. And when you use the code PACKET25 at checkout, you will save an additional 25% off your membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just be sure to use that code PACKET25 at checkout. That is PACKET25. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. And now back to the show.
And you talked about this before, like, bits and pieces, right? We didn't start out with, hey, we had this ginormous automation thing. We said, okay, let's do Quas. Let's add Syslog. Let's add NTP. Let's add all those other types of things.
So
right?
you built up this muscle. So you started by doing just the Quas policies in Glue Air, and then you said, oh, we'll go and we need to unify the Syslog stuff. So we'll just send this rule out to all the devices with Syslog. And when that worked, and then you just kept on iterating here.
Exactly. And, you know, I've called it common services. And, you know, and a lot of people have some very bad memory about, you know, one time somebody wrote a script, or they did Python, they broke all this other type of stuff. But we really focused on common services at first. Now, DVPN, it's all done, right? Yeah. Because we can control that from start to finish. And it's completely kind of disconnected because we use the VRFs from the service provider, right? But this is the thing we tried to focus on, but people are still very, very nervous about it. So all common services are done. Now, we had to build 3 SNMP things and 3 syslog things because the traps are sent locally in region.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's a model of automation. One other issue that we had, which is solved, but I haven't not had time to do it, the service provider would put a tag in. Right. So you build the model of automation. Right. And so that was the problem. Like with DVPN, it's easy. Like you can clearly define all that, but we can't tell AT&T or whoever to what tag you're going to build. So we have about 80 different kind of buckets of automation called assemblies for the service providers. We can solve that now, but we haven't done it yet.
I think there's one thing we might need to explain here as I'm thinking back over our conversation. When you say model, what does that mean? Does that mean I know that the configuration of the router should be, you know, this, but that there's many ways that this implementation of this QoS policy could go? Because if I'm talking to a 2800 switch, there's only this type of QoS capability, but if I'm talking to this type of switch, it's a different one. So when you say model, are you actually saying, and correct me where I'm wrong here, I know what I want to achieve, but I've also got to calculate the what actually goes down to each device, just like I would if I was doing it manually, CLI-wise, but you're actually creating an automation process that says, here's my desired QoS state, here's the device it's going to, oh, I need to change my QoS policy, and now I'll push the QoS policy into that unit.
Well, that is really the part of this whole journey that really has to make me the most, because it's completely abstracted across lines. So we have last count, I think some of them have been replaced now, but at one point we're making changes on 12 different devices, all the way from a 4451 to a 3725 across a plethora of iOS code too. Yeah. And that was the part that really was amazing, that it's the same. When you talk about a model, there's a piece of it's all broken down by pieces of the iOS, right?
Yeah, stanzas out of the iOS. I call them stanzas in my head. And when I work in iOS, this is a stanza of like a poet in a poem. The poet runs
exactly.
From stuff, and there's all these stanzas in the middle. And iOS is a group of stanzas in the poem sort of thing.
And that is really the problem that we found. So we did this several years ago for a SaaS application. I've talked about this a lot, called Simplicity, where they downloaded this tool on your desktop and it just took your local hard drive and punted it to the cloud, right? So that really buried everything because there was no QoS policy. But and then we pay... You know, I talk about this a lot too. We have third parties managing everything. We're a huge organization. Yeah. So we paid them to do QoS. And they have this standard. But when you copy and paste that standard in, it doesn't work, right? Because it wouldn't work across all platforms. As a result, one in six devices, even though we paid quite a bit of money to it, did not have QoS on it until we did this automation with Glueware. Now, it's completely abstracted. And, you know, I could do a live thing today. I could go on right now, select all devices, we could change one line of code in QoS policy if we wanted to add something to it, or SNMP, hit the button, and it would just go and do it, right? Yeah. So that was really a big trick, that the JSON libraries, it's all completely abstracted.
Yeah.
Right. But you couldn't copy and paste it in. You couldn't copy and paste the policy in because it's all different. But
yeah, sometimes when you inject a stanza on an iOS device, it goes. And sometimes, and when if you want to, but in other cases, if there's something there, you have to back that out first. And that was the logic. Is that the sort of thing that was missing?
That's exactly right. And that's a great point. And that's exactly what we have done, right? That you couldn't copy and paste these standards in because the standard is not always backwards compatible, right? Mm. And it even changes version of code to version of code. And I'll give you another great example of that, and it has to do with what we did with switching, right? We have all of NAC done, and NAC is ginormous on a switch. It's just huge, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden, the guys go, well, we need to have exceptions in NAC. So we built something into the automation strategy that you put a description on the port called NAC exception. So the tool will run, and any description, so you need a primer, right?
Yeah.
So it finds that primer and it removes NAC on that port very simply and easily. But this is exactly the power of what we've been doing.
Yeah.
But to the QoS point, like, it doesn't matter. Like, all this old stuff, it's all completely abstracted. It doesn't work. It does not fail.
Yeah.
There's other times when it will break. And then, so for example, another thing we found, Telnet on an SSH port, right? And the automation model failed. And we went in and we fixed it, right? And we fixed it with Glueware. But the problem is that you can't go and find everything. So what we're doing now is building something called a configuration audit, that you run the audit and see what's not there. So I'd like to boil the configurations down to a bare minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So people can't just copy and paste stuff in and do the rest with automation. So we really have a true platform.
So some of that sounds like you could have done all this in Python and Ansible. So why didn't you? Why use an orchestration engine like Glueware instead of using an automation engine like Python and Ansible?
So let's say we built the script for, you know, a 2900 router or a 3900 router on this version of code. If you tried to run that on the next version of code, it probably wouldn't work, right? Because all the changes, like there's all these little pieces, and you know, right? And everybody knows that as you move to a version of code, especially from like 3.7, like to pre-Denali and post-Denali code, the changes were significant, right? So you would have had to go and change all your playbooks to do that. And the thing is that—
And then you would have to detect the device before you send the script to it as well.
Exactly, right? So, and the difference is, if you can, like right now, we could log into a box, create a pile of script, right? A pile of code, copy and paste it in. But what will not happen, you can't take the stuff out. So that is a key differentiator. And Jeff Gray and Olivier from Glue, they talk a lot about this, right? What true declarative model means, right? So when we first did the routers, we took out 1,000 lines of code as well as putting 1,000 lines of code, because what's not in your model that you built, there's a section that will say, I'm only allowing these commands. And if anything that's not allowed, it takes out. And that is the trick. You don't have to do know this or know that. Mm-hmm. It will automatically do it. Like AutoQS is another example.
So the platform, the Glueware platform that you're using, is automatically saying these lines shouldn't be, if I'm applying this policy, this cost policy, this stuff shouldn't be here. I'll pull that out for you and force conformance.
Exactly. That is really, in my opinion, the biggest trick that they've done. Right.
So you didn't have to program any of that. You didn't have to customize. They do all that for you. In effect, like it's just part of the platform.
It's the intent. You have to really talk about intent networking. This is really true intent networking, that you really say, what do we want to do? And then you build this, and then you say, what's not in here? There are certain pieces of the puzzle in these different iterations of these models we have where we say only let these commands exist.
Yeah.
So if there's old stuff that's been on there for a while, and you can find all kinds of old stuff because people have just been, I mean, let's face reality, right? I mean, I'm sure any enterprise, but so the thing is, we can remove all that stuff. And now we're going into the next phase with some of the other customers have done this thing called configuration audit, right? And now what's cool about configuration audit, and it's much easier to do than automation, because you can say, let's look for these parameters or look for some regexes, run this across these devices and find one of these corner cases where somebody left telnet on the VTY lines or something like that. So that's what we're kind of doing now. We're running a configuration audit. And the difference is that you can then schedule a remediation.
Right.
Which is the key part. So these guys are working with HTTP NAS and all this other type of stuff, doing IKO queues and manual health checks. But the difference is, once you build that out, and that's what I'm going to be working on this week, once you build that out, you run the audit, it'll tell you what's missing, and then you can just click a button and remediate it, and you're back in business. Yep.
Okay, so you really are doing a configuration audit, but you're also doing a configuration remediation. If VTY is still enabled on this, you know, you find a router in an acquisition. I'm thinking you get an acquisition, all of a sudden you see there's a 2850 router, it's coming into your system, you can start to do remediation, which says, oh, they're using Telnet here, which maybe that company just never got around to it, or, you know.
Exactly.
You can switch it over to SSH, you can push out a proper SSH public key to the device so that you can do SSH logins and blah, blah, blah. But the point I think I'm trying to make is that the SDN platform that you've chosen does that for you. You don't have to work out how that works to some... You have to do some work, right? It's still not, a magic wand. Make it so, right? That's not the intent, the intent magic wand, which you just wave it around like they do in marketing land. There's still a lot of hard work that goes in here, but there's not hundreds of hours of Python and Ansible and testing and, right? Even if you could find a Python Ansible expert.
No, you can't. And I'm glad you mentioned that. So it is a lot of development work. And we spent a lot of time going through this stuff, building it and doing all this stuff. But once it's done and you test it, that's 95% of the work. Then you import the devices and you can run a preview and it'll actually tell you what's going to put in, take out, and then you can automate. But you're absolutely right. There's no such thing as a free lunch, right?
No.
You have to put the time in, figure out exactly what you want to do, and then make it happen. But the whole trick is we're able to yank out a bunch of things that we really don't need.
Now, you said to me that during the process, you know, in our previous conversations, one of the things that you said to me was you just couldn't find enough people with Python and Ansible and networking skills to make this work at your, now maybe your scale is unique or your situation is unique. I'm willing to accept partially that, but I don't think that's true. I just don't think that a lot of network engineers are good programmers, and I don't think we may never have enough programmer-ready network engineers to be able to write Ansible at scale. Even with Ansible Tower is a good step in that direction, in that it's a framework and it's starting to replace, right? It's starting to say, like, why are we always reinventing the wheel? Why does everybody have to define the SSH? Why doesn't Ansible Tower work out how to SSH into this network device, that network device? So they're moving down that path, but they're not as far down as what it sounds like you need.
We'll be back to this podcast shortly, but we're going to talk about ExtraHop, a Packet Pusher sponsor, first. Your job probably includes managing applications, network infrastructure, and so on. But how do you do that when you can't even see everything those apps are running on, when half the network the app is running across isn't even yours? Add to that SDN changing things in automated ways that maybe feel out of your control, or devs and other business units firing up their own cloud instances and then expecting you to support it even though you've got zero instrumentation. These scenarios are some of the ways that ExtraHop can help. ExtraHop is a leader in network analytics, and they help you consolidate tools into their analytics platform and make sense of application performance running over infrastructure that's sprawled beyond your data center and across the internet and then into the cloud. ExtraHop offers complete visibility and leverages machine learning to help you make sense of the mountain of metadata about your network, and in the end, you can make informed decisions about your IT stack and do it quickly. If you go to extrahop.com/packetpushers, you can find out more about the ExtraHop performance platform. Once more, that is extrahop.com/packetpushers. And now, back to the show.
That's so true, Greg. I mean, you just can't find, like, we have job recs open globally for, and you know, and the benefits package here, it's great, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the stock's great, but it's very hard to find people to do it. And the other thing is, like, and a lot of the guys from Network to Code were at your event, mm-hmm. right? I don't think you could do it, what I'm doing today with Ansible. And I said this before, look, yeah. And IP Space, Ivan, all these people, all these automation classes. And I don't think you could do what we're doing. So to answer your first question, I don't think these people really exist. I mean, I'm interviewing people now here for us, tier three network positions, network engineering positions. And it's rough. It's rough. And you start thinking, hey, maybe I'm really underpaid, right? Maybe I really am a rocket scientist, which I'm clearly not.
No.
Right?
But, that's a tough one. Let's go down that rabbit. I mean, that's an interesting one. One of the problems that you do have when you do interview people is, and I've fallen into this plenty of times myself, is you start to think, how do these people not know what I know? And then all of a sudden I wake up and go, like, that's because I do it every day and they haven't, right?
Yeah. I know.
It's an interesting one. You can convince yourself that you're smarter than you actually are until you, if you don't snap out of it. You know.
Until reality hits, right? And and then the network melts, you're like, oh crap. How do I figure out until something melts, you're like, oh man. So, because you know, again, if you don't do deep level troubleshooting every day, you kinda, and I'm kinda trying to get away from that because I've sat through enough fire drills, right? But you kinda lose that too, and then you're like, oh my god, I'm such a dumbass. Why can't I figure this problem out, you know?
Yeah. So I think I've often talked about the difference between automation, orchestration, and intent. So automation is what I call toil replacement or work replacement. That is, if you're logging into a unit and you're typing the same thing over and over, automating that gives you a benefit, right? You definitely get an immediate, if you're going to a firewall and constantly adding firewall rules, if you write a script that can just start adding firewall rules for you that you've pre-written, you're going to get a lot of benefits almost immediately, right? But if you're, and it might scale to 100 firewalls, but you're still only configuring one firewall at a time, right? So you're just, you know, run this script on that firewall and it puts that firewall rule into that firewall. That's a good start, but it's not really. And then the next phase from that is you say, well, what we want to do is multi-automations. And you start saying, well, what I want to do is be able to create a firewall rule and then for the script to automatically go out to any number of, you know, to five different brands of devices in my network and implement it somehow. And that's okay because that's not too hard. That's complicated automation. But then all of a sudden you start looking at, I've got to do firewalls and now I want to do the routers and I want to do the switches And, you know, so now I'm starting to get into multi-automations across multiple platforms. And I think this is where automation falls down and you start needing an orchestration product of some sort. And I think the orchestration products that we've talked about today, like ACI or Glueware, fall into two camps. One of them is they solve half of the automation problem by just forcing you to throw out all the old stuff and forcing you to some new stuff. So now all of a sudden the automation's quite straightforward because they've got modern operating systems, modern hardware, sure. It's all clearly defined. It's all pretty, that's not too hard, right? If you think about it, it's like saying, I've got a fleet, you know, if I'm somebody who's running a fleet of cars, let's say I work for the purchasing department and I've got 1,000 cars, and you know that all the modern cars run twice as efficiently and have half the breakdowns. So if you just went out and bought a whole bunch of new cars, everything just runs better, right? So
sure.
I just think, you know, the thing about ACI is that they say you can have ACI, but you can't have a Nexus 7000. You have to have a Nexus 9000
exactly.
And you have to run this code that's custom written to work with that. Now, that's fine because that solves some of the problem, but that's a really expensive way, expensive in terms of capital, sure. Spending money, expensive in terms of resources. I've got to throw out all my old switches and fit them and go through the change and the project basis. So I think that's orchestration. When you get to orchestration, there's two choices. There's two forks that you take. One is throw out my old network, put a new orchestration engine in and take advantage of the new features, and it'll work pretty well. It's an easy way out. It's lazy, expensive, but whatever, that's good. But there's also an orchestration path that some of the vendors are going down, and this is what I think you've done, which is said, I can do multi-automations if I do a really smart software engine in the middle. And then I think what Glueware has done is then taken your orchestration piece and stepped up to the next level and said, I can now start to devolve intent. So I can say, I know that Sal wants this cost policy. I can bring some smarts into there and work out what orchestrations I need to make that cost policy go out as an automation. Does that make sense? Is that your...
Yeah, no, that does make sense. And again, I've been asked by the ONUG board to be a co-chairman of the Orchestration Automation Committee. And you're right, defining what these things are and what everybody's doing. So I think what we're doing, like, I don't know if what I'm doing would be orchestration because we are doing switches and routers, right? Mm. You still have to click the button, right? I have done this little trick for firewalls. I started doing some NXOS stuff. So is that just automation or is that orchestration because you're doing multiple devices?
Yeah.
But to that point, right? Like if I wanted to tie in Remedy into Glueware, so a change in Remedy will trigger the change in Glueware to make an SNMP change or something like that, right? To me, that's orchestration level, right? Having high up, open daylight or that kind of promise. And so what I'm trying to do now with this ONUG committee, right? And I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to England to meet you, see you in person, but what are people doing? So I set, we're doing an RFP right now. I set some very long meetings with every, 10 vendors. And a lot of these global service providers have spent billions on their orchestration piece, right? But I'm like, well, what can you really do? But then, of course, you have to open up your network to them. So as this evolves, too, I'd love to come back. And next week, I have very detailed 3-hour meetings with them to really see what they're going to do. But again, I don't think everybody's in the same boat rowing the same direction, right? Like, is that orchestrators really exist, right? Okay, so another example I asked them. So a circuit is getting very busy, right? Is there artificial intelligence to automatically do that upgrade, right? Mm. Now, is that automation or is that like, what is that? Is that orchestration?
Yeah.
So you can look at all your circuits. I mean, it's really kind of murky, pun intended.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of issues there. I think one of them is there's automation, single task automation, and then there's multitask automation, and then there's multi-silo automations. So,
yes.
Right? So if I start bridging what my carrier wants versus what my WAN wants versus what my data center, or if I'm in the data center, I want to actually orchestrate storage as well as compute, as well as VM, as well as network. So I think when you get into multi-silo automation, you're actually orchestration. So my definition for orchestration now is becoming multi-silo automations. I need to have, or multi-party multi-silo. So let's say I've got an SD-WAN, but I now want the SD-WAN to talk to the telco. So you want more bandwidth. So if you've got a 1 gig tail at this branch and if this circuit, you should be able to go into your SD-WAN platform and say, upgrade it from 400 megs to 500 megs, click, and it should just go through. And there's some sort of approval, email goes to the CIO,
of course.
Whatever. And then, a contract gets sent out to the purchasing department. But at some point, whatever, it should happen.
Exactly.
And in your SD-WAN platform, you should see requests made, CIO approved, carrier working, right? And you know that's where it's going to stay for 3 months, but hey, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the dream, right? So I think there's sort of, this is where intent comes in, is in when you get into multi-party, multi-silo, multi-device, multi-vendor, multi-multi-multis, I think a lot of people are still in the very early stages of automation, and they're thinking, if I just do this thing, then I'm automating and I'm very clever and I'm doing great. But looking down the pipe on the, as you fan out in the longer term strategy, which I think is what you're looking at, you're saying, what happens when I'm bringing together the WAN and the branch and the Wi-Fi and the campus in my factories, and I'm bringing together, you know, all these other things? How do I do all that? And I think that's the difference between automation versus orchestration and intent, is this increasing level of complexity, multi-party, multi-silo, multi-network.
Yeah, no, you're spot on, and that's exactly the problem, and that's what I'm trying to get these service providers to comment on, and I'm talking to the ONU community about this as well. But right now I don't think there is one simple solution to do what we need to do. I mean, clearly we're orchestrating with Glue across many platforms, right? And it's very interesting. Some of the new things coming out with are just absolutely incredible. But getting that whole piece of the puzzle, and a lot of companies have spent a lot of money. Some people with very deep pockets are spending millions and millions of dollars on NSO development and this type of thing. But what I'm trying to get the ONU community to wrap around is, like, what are people doing? How are they solving it? Is everybody just building these point solutions?
Yeah.
Right? Is everybody just going down their own little private Idaho? But to your point, like, how do you bring the whole thing together? And I don't know if it's that easy, but as I move forward through this RFP, I'm really asking these guys to pitch, because we have a huge metropolitan network, right?
Yeah.
We have huge MPLS network, right? So, and there's several things like cloud to the edge, security to the edge, applying any to any transport. So, but it all kind of dovetails together into a bigger picture, which is, it's going to take some time to wrap our arms around it. And even some of the new SD-WAN stuff, it's interesting. Right. I mean, we looked at a lot of these things.
SD-WAN is where you're now working. So you're looking at the SD-WAN and going through an RFP process for what you might want to have going forward there.
Yeah, of course. And that's the whole thing. When you start looking at these things, and again, what we're doing now, we're not changing control plane. When you really talk about changing a control plane across every device, that's that'll be an interesting one, right?
Yeah. So,
and I've done it. Like, I have Viptela set up here, you know, it's quite interesting, but again, like, making a central change like that with the control plane across everything, that's going to be very interesting paradox to get in. Like, even DNVPN, right? It's really single. There's a single control plane on that box, right?
Well, it's a shared complete. The thing about DMVPN is it's actually a shared control plane. Every device in the network is shared. And there's like sometimes I think of it as a consensual hallucination that this is the configuration of the network. It's not actually.
<That's funny.
laughs> 400 nodes in a DMVPN, there's 400 configurations and they all end up working the same. I think with an SD-WAN, this central controller idea, either if you're used to this distributed model, and then all of a sudden you flip to the SD-WAN where there's a central controller, can be very scary, I think, for people, because you're suddenly thinking there's one point of failure. It's not. It's a better point of failure because it actually very rarely fails. And they forget that there's still configuration in each box at the edge. It's just not active. Like, in a distributed networking strategy like DMVPN or BGP routing or MPLS, we use these protocols to distribute configuration information. That's what they're for, right?
Sure.
And then the box itself does its own configuration based on DMVPN or BGP or LDP or OSPF or whatever it is, right? The only thing that's not dynamically propagated is a QoS policy or similar, right? And so SD-WAN is still the same. The boxes are still configuring themselves. It's just the configuration comes from an SD-WAN controller. I think the interesting part is, would you ever consider using Python and Ansible over your Viptela or your Glueware or your ACI to drive configurations and to start to do multi-silo orchestration? Is that a reality, or is that too far away?
We'll have to see what happens with this RFP going on, and a lot of people are pitching some very interesting things. But I'd really like to see what we can do to get to, like, the higher level piece. And I always get back to, like, we're having performance issues at a site. Right? I don't even want to know about it. right? What can we use to orchestrate that? So we're asking for very large access ports, mm-hmm. right? And just to be able to react to the needs of the business. So one day we might get a call, hey, 500 people are moving to the site in Norway. And they're walking across the street with their stuff. And then it's like, oh my gosh, like, what are we going to do? We need more switches and that kind of thing. Yeah. But at least if we were in a position to have a device there, and this is why I like this NFV solution, right? Because you can add more, it's just a white pizza box, right? In theory, there should be a lot of memory and that kind of thing. And you just say, okay, click a button and or have it automatically ramp up the CPU cycles or whatever, right? But I don't know. So I'm not opposed to, you know, Ansible or Python or something like that to do it. There's a couple of products that seem to have some promise in this space. But as I keep drilling in more to the Open Network User Group, and we got to really see. But I'm not opposed to anything at this point, right? No. But it's got to be. It's one thing to engineer something, and it's something else to have people be able to support it, right?
Especially now, right? I think one of the things that you've got with the advantages of what you've done with the glueware orchestration is you don't need people to support some stuff. So once upon a time, somebody would have handcrafted it all and put it in, and then somebody would have gone back to check their work. And so in some ways, scaling your performance is actually just using automation to replace some of it. I want to come back to your point about NFV and SD-WAN. So you're coming around your current vision, and it'll change as you go through the cycle and you learn what's happening, I suspect, is to have a universal x86 type box at the edge of the network, and it might have a number of VMs, and some of them might be SD-WAN, they might be WAN accelerators, they might be firewalls, they might be logging engines, security, you know, whatever it is. That's something that's attractive to you at this point?
Right now, I'm testing this. I've been testing some Ensemble, which is kind of interesting, right? But to me, that breaks any ties that bind to any vendor, like we were talking about early on, right? Yeah. So if we said, hey, we think that Versa is better, or we'd say, hey, no, VeloCloud just did something, or Silverpeak, it gives you that flexibility. You even talked about this on one of your articles, many articles about running multiple SD-WAN providers at the same time, right?
That's the thing, is you don't need to have just one SD-WAN. You could have two. You could have vendor A here and vendor B there, and they're all just sharing. It's just an overlay. So what does it matter, right? It doesn't. You can literally migrate between SD-WAN solutions without having an apocalyptic event. Like, you don't have to shut it down. But, like we do with BGP today. If you wanted to migrate from BGP to a new version to BGP version 6 or something, you know, whatever the next BGP would be. Not that that's ever going to happen, but if that was a hypothetical, there's no way to run them side by side. But in SD-WAN's case, you can just run, they're just over the top. So why not run 2 or 3 or 4? Why not run vendor 1 in Asia Pacific and vendor 2 in Norway? There's no reason not to in that sense.
But at the edge, until you get to this bright box, white box, magic pizza box at the edge, right? You're kind of married to this hardware paradigm. And that's what I want to get away from, right? I want to get to the point where we could, but we right now, look, we're stuck in this paradox that we have a lot of these very expensive routers out there that we have to use, right? That we're not going to lay them to waste. Although some people might, you know, I mean, some vendors are saying, well, hey, maybe we buy these back from you and you put in our huge orchestration tool. Some vendors are saying, hey, we spent $5 billion on this magic automation thing and it has all these things we're talking about, right? But that remains to be seen, because that means opening up our network to some cloud controller. I said, okay, that sounds great. I want an OVA. Let me set one up in my lab. But of course, they won't do that, right? No. They're not, because it's all on their controller.
It comes back to the, there's two types of SD-WAN vendors out there at the moment. There's one that says, buy my new hardware with my SD-WAN on it and our cloud controller. And of course, they get the benefit of selling the hardware and the licensing and the SD-WAN controller, right? That's good revenue for them. Very good product management. And if you can convince customers that that's a choice, that's one. But there's a range of other customers. Like, I remember talking to the Viptela people before they were acquired by Cisco, and they were using a $500 x86 appliance before. So, you know, it didn't need... Now, I'm sure Cisco's put a lot more features and functionality in there, and it might be a lot harder.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot more functionality in there, and so it needs a lot more than it used to. Like, as these SD-WAN solutions scale up in complexity, they burn more CPU, need more memory, and the SSDs, you know, and that sort of stuff. But notwithstanding, it doesn't – even a $2,000 or a $5,000 Cisco UCS server has got far more functionality and forwarding performance than a – to my mind still – than a, 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 an NCS router of the, and they'll tell you all of these magic things about those routers, about how something, 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 but I'm not always convinced that that's something I want. For some people, there's definitely a place for those. If you want the extended thermal range and the root of trust and the, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But the other one is the people who are literally building an NFV platform. So they use a white box server, they put some software on it, and they run the NFV for you. So you, a bit like VMware gives you ESX and lets you manage the VMs. That's what I would want in my branch router if I was in your shoes, because I would want to be able to say, yeah, we're using Checkpoint routers in this part of the world, so Checkpoint firewalls. Too hard to change right now, but at least I can spin up another one in the future and switch from Checkpoint to Palo Alto, if that was my thing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That is clearly the future, right? Yeah. I mean, I'd like to get that done. And even, you know, I just, we talked about the data center people, Apstra. I just did a demo with Apstra the other day, too, and it was very interesting what they've done, what their new version, I think they're on 3.02.
Yeah.
And they were talking about a lot about any bright box, white box will work with their solution. And I thought that was kind of interesting, but it's the same kind of thing, right? We're not going to ever, you know, break this. Like if you were a riverbed shop, right? Why wouldn't you, how could you ever not put Silver Peak in? Right. Yeah. Or could you put other things without Silver Peak? And I think Versa too, you may be able to put some other VMs on there too.
Yes.
But again, like we have this large capital expense out there, but next iteration,
but you want, you want to have something that you can start with now and then have a vision for where you're going to be in 5 to 10 years. There's another one, another approach to SD-WAN, which I'll throw at you, is that some of them are actually security centric. So there's a company called Open Systems and they were a SOC.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah. They were a SOC first and an SD-WAN second. And that's a really interesting, and they're still on the NFV model too. But I thought that was very interesting in the sense that they have all the security. So a lot of the SD-WAN vendors are network centric. And they just say security is, you know, send it to Zscaler or Cisco Umbrella or whatever. And it's kind of like, that's not my problem. You know, well, that's too much hassle.
Right.
And that's not what I kind of, if I was in your shoes as a strategy person, I would much more want to see security as baked in, not as an add-on.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Exactly.
Yeah, I want to know that.
It makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And that was one of the paradigms that I put into this RFI from these vendors, right? Security at the edge. Any transport over any medium, cloud to the edge and all this type of stuff. And very few of them really hit the mark. Like a couple of them really did a phenomenal job. And as this process goes on, maybe we can have a chat about it again the year is up. But it's going to be interesting what they're really pitching. So people had, some of them had a myopic view of the world. Oh, what about this? And I said, well, okay, you're only looking at one small piece of the puzzle. And what I want to see is, what do we do with the metropolitan air network? What do we do with the internet? What do we do with colos? What do we do with cloud? Mm. And I think it was kind of hard for some people to wrap their heads around what I was actually asking them to do, right? Because a couple of them really hit the nail right in the head. I was very impressed, right? But some of them were like, did you see the sign on the door? This is Merck, right? I mean, did you not know where you are?
Yeah. Right? Sometimes if your only tool's a hammer, your only tool's a hammer. So I call that the old Cabletron. I call that the old Cabletron model. You know, the Cabletron guys, they had 50 features. That was all they had. Cisco had like 800 at the time, and so but the Cabletron guys would come in, and the big one was SNMP for them, and they'd come in and sell the heck out of SNMP. Now sometimes it worked, and yay they won because of their management engine. And people forgot that all the other stuff that didn't have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you remember the
and
old?
Oh, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, by the way. No, we don't do. Yeah. No, we've got this great box and it's good for switching, but we don't do any routing whatsoever. It's like, oh, hang on.
Yeah,
whatever.
Oh, wait a minute here. Yeah.
Wait a minute. You mean, I feel a little, so interesting sort of times. Well, Sal, I think we should wrap the conversation up here. We've probably reached the limit of the audience's patience. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Where can people find you?
They can find me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I have a very unique name, Salvatore Ranazzisi.
I recommend look at the show notes.
LinkedIn.
Don't get him to spell it.
Salad Onug. I have that email. I'm going to test that that's going to work this week. It might be a little bit easier. And please come to Onug in New York. If anybody wants to get more involved in this new orchestration automation work group, it'd be very interesting. I'm just trying to get some ideas. of what people are doing, how we can solve some of these problems and move on. But once again, Greg, always a pleasure speaking to you. And thanks for having me on the show. Greatly appreciate it.
And it's great for you to come on. I really appreciate you talking so freely and openly about your situation. And it's very interesting to have these strategy discussions. And hopefully you and the audience have heard some ideas that might be relevant to your network. As Sal said, he's getting into the owner goal. I really like the fact that you're getting involved in trying to drag the industry with you. In a, you know, like putting something out there.
Not
for
always easy.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We'll see what happens. It's hard to tell if things are changing. Maybe our vendors are actually becoming customer focused instead of just giving
us.
Yeah, here's hope so. Well, on that note, you can find many more fine free shows like this on all of your favorite podcatchers and podcast clients. And if you visit packetpushers.net, you can discover many more of these episodes from across our podcast networking for not only just networking people, but infrastructure professionals more generally. We've got blogs, news feeds, Twitters, LinkedIns. You find us on Apple Podcasts, all the things. And don't forget our membership site at ignition.packetpushers.net. You can support us by being a member, and hopefully we'll be able to bring you more content from there. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.